the Slavonic Rhapsody No. 3 by Dvořák. Thanks to a performance of the Stabat Mater at the Royal Albert Hall in March 1883, an invitation to Dvořák soon followed from the Philharmonic Society of London to write a new work for them and to come over and conduct it. We'll hear about his extraordinary reception here tomorrow and some of the works he premiered when he came, including his cantata, The Spectre's Bride, his hugely popular Scherzo Capriccioso, part of the symphony written for the Philharmonic Society, and perhaps the greatest of his liturgical works, Dvořák's Requiem.
Composer of the Week is presented by Donald MacLeod. This week's series of programmes is produced in Cardiff by Deborah Preston, and Donald will be back tomorrow with that second programme in the series, earlier than usual at 6 o'clock tomorrow. Hello, I'm John Shea. Welcome to Monday Evening on BBC Radio 3. It's the last week of the prom season, can you believe it? 7:30 now, time to go to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom, and waiting to join us there, Andrew McGregor.
The promenaders have just given a warm welcome to this evening's visiting orchestra, the Oslo Philharmonic, for their first of their two proms. And earlier today I was asking their chief conductor designate, Vasily Petrenko, about his Norwegian orchestra. And he told me that while they might be geographically closer to Russia, after 7 years in Liverpool, he's got the sound he wants there in Russian repertoire. The Norwegians, though, he reckons still owe much of their character to the last two music directors, Marit Jansons until 2002, and now Jukka-Pekka Saraste, who's made them more of a Finnish ensemble, thinks Petrenko. So he's really relishing this evening's opportunity to remind them of their Slavic roots, starting with early Tchaikovsky, his first symphony, Winter Daydreams, ending with late Rachmaninoff, his symphonic dances. And at the start of the concert's second half, Polish composer Karol Szymanowski's beautiful, sensuous and ethereal Violin Concerto No. 1, a great favourite of our Latvian soloist this evening, Vaiba Skrida, as she'll be telling us later. But what about Tchaikovsky's first symphony? He'd only just graduated from the St. Petersburg Conservatory when he started writing it, so is Petrenko surprised it doesn't sound more like a student work?
He's a bit naive, which is great. He's very sincere, very humble in his writing there. And of course it does have the Russian folk tunes and Russian winter in it. I think that he had a program for first movement, obviously, for second, and for Scherzo too. This fantasy of the winter blizzard or something like that, plus the warmth of the fireplace in the middle of the third movement. So Scherzo is pretty much programmed. And then he wrote the finale, which, of course, it summarized what happened before. It includes a lot of music from the previous movements, and it has this glorification at the end. And it sounds, for me personally, as the winter is over, and then there's this pancakes week, very famous in Russia, before Easter, when the people were got wild and mad. There have been fighting between the cities, but the Russian people, after that, they were kissing each other, and then you can already see the first signs of the spring. So this last movement is this transition from late January or February, when you still have a lot of snow, very long nights, towards some celebration, even some wild celebration at the very end. And it's glorification of the spring coming.
Vasily Petrenko, this evening's conductor, with his personal view of the journey on which we're about to embark as Tchaikovsky begins his career as a symphonic composer. Well, the Oslo Philharmonic's leader, Eliza Botnes, just tuned the orchestra here to conduct them in Tchaikovsky's Winter Daydreams, is chief conductor designate Vasily Petrenko.
Thank you.
The end of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 1 in G minor. The arrival of spring after those winter daydreams, thinks this evening's conductor Vasily Petrenko, who you've just heard with the first of this week's visiting orchestras here at the BBC Proms, the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra. And Petrenko was dancing his way through that finale. Here he comes back onto the platform. And roars of applause for the Oslo Philharmonic's principal oboist. Now the horn section making such a splendid sound in that symphony. Symphonist and the rest of the percussion and the brass at the back of the orchestra there. And just remember that despite Rimsky-Korsakov's first symphony just before, whose premiere Tchaikovsky had heard, there was really no native symphonic tradition for Tchaikovsky to tap into as he embarked on his exploration of Western symphonic form with all those Russian musical ideas. And he still regarded his first symphony with affection years later. Despite all its shortcomings, he wrote, I still nourish a weakness for it because it was a sin of my sweet youth. Back comes Vasily Petrenko once again. When he was rehearsing the Oslo Philharmonic this morning, he was asking them for what he called a different kind of lightness in the third movement, but he ended up telling them at the end, I quite like your version. And he said at the start of the symphony to imagine a desolate Russian winter landscape, snow, ice, no people, maybe just the occasional bear. The whole orchestra standing now as Petrenko bows low in front of the promenaders. And by the way, don't forget you can hear Osmo Vanska conducting Tchaikovsky's sixth and last symphony, the Patatik Symphony, in Wednesday's prom, live here on BBC Radio 3. The symphony he finished just a couple of months before his death, and already in that first symphony we just heard, quite a few signifers for it, I think. Well, there'll be a different kind of Russian nostalgia at work in the second half of this evening's prom, which ends with Rachmaninoff's last orchestral work, his mighty Symphonic Dances. And before it, Petrenko's Norwegians are joined by our Latvian soloist, Biba Skrida, who was telling me earlier how much she's looking forward to making her prom's debut this evening with Karol Szymanowski's highly original and often startlingly beautiful Violin Concerto No. 1. Meanwhile, it's time for this evening's Proms Plus literary event. And at the Royal College of Music earlier this evening, Ian McMillan and his guests celebrated the life and poetry of Louis McNeice 50 years after his death, and also marked the demise just days ago of his fellow Irishman, Seamus Heaney.
Tonight, I'm talking to the former Poet Laureate Sir Andrew Motion and the poet Paul Farley about Louis McNeice. He was part of the celebrated 1930s generation that included Auden, Day Lewis and Spender, and he'd have liked these Proms Plus events because he was both a radio playwright and a radio producer. The Irish writer Glenn Patterson said of him that reading McNeice was like a light coming on. And the poet Nick Laird said of McNeice that Louis McNeice's influence is everywhere in contemporary poetry, in its forms and in its forms of engagement. But as we approach the 50th anniversary of his death, tomorrow in fact, it seems to me that he's in danger of being forgotten. So, Andrew, let's start with you. When did you first come across Louis McNeice as a writer?
I think I probably read one or two poems by him as a schoolboy. So that would have been in the 1960s, but really only one or two. And he was very, very much in Auden's shadow and introduced to me as somebody who lived in Auden's shadow, had written in Auden's shadow and had remained in it in some way. Then when I arrived at university, I fell in love with somebody who I later married, who was very keen on McNeice. So guess what? Yeah. I got very keen on McNeice. It seemed absolutely the thing that I had to do. And I very quickly, of course, realized that she was onto an extraordinarily good thing. And I still find it very difficult. In fact, I found it impossible to read McNeice without thinking about her, which is not inappropriate, given, as I'm sure we'll be saying soon, how many of his own poems are triggered by and in some way or other, to do with love.
What about you, Paul? Where did you come across McNeice?
I first read him, you know, in earnest. I think I read him when I was much younger, but I first read him in earnest about 20-something years ago when I was living in a flat in King's Cross, one really cold winter, and the person that had been in the room before me had left a bunch of poetry books, and one of them was McNeice's Selected. And the first poem I remember reading, predictably, I suppose, was Snow. just what is between the glass and the huge road. I'm not sure I've ever figured that out, but that's what makes it endlessly mysterious, and you want to keep going back to it.
What about that idea of Nick Laird's, that his influence is everywhere in contemporary poetry?
Yeah, I think he's an incredibly influential poet, but I think he's cursed with this poet's poet tag. I don't know what that is, but I don't like the sound of it, you know? He's a poet's poet, which means that if you talk to people outside of the tribe, if you like, you often are met with blank looks, you know? He's not so well-known as we might perhaps assume he is. But within poetry, I think there is... He feels ubiquitous. Everybody knows who he is, and there has definitely been an influence, of course.
And we call him Anglo-Irish, and that's a funny term. It's like Anglo-Welsh. But do you think that phrase, Anglo-Irish, Andrew, gets us any closer to understanding McNeice?
I think that one of the reasons why he matters to so many people in the way that he does matter is because the poems are crucially to do with displacements, deracinations of one kind or another. The problem that I have with the phrase Anglo-Irish is it suggests that there is somewhere between England and Ireland where such people live, which could only be the Isle of Man, but that can't be, or Douglas, or somewhere, which can't really be the answer, can it? I think it's more interesting, perhaps, to think about McNeice as somebody who doesn't really belong quite in Ireland, feels he doesn't really quite belong in Ireland, and also feels he doesn't quite belong in England either. So, given that things to do with the diaspora are so much the currency of modern poetry, our contemporary poetry, his importance plays into that, I think.
Now, Louis McNeice's poems are read for us tonight by the actor Nicholas Farrell, and we're going to begin with that poem that Paul mentioned earlier, Snow. So, Andrew, what made you choose this poem?
Well, I chose it... It's a poem called Snow, and it's a chestnut. It's a poem called Snow, in which he eats a tangerine, and it's a chestnut. It's probably his best-known poem, and I think the reason it's his best-known poem is that it has something to do with the fact that it's very short, and it has something much more interesting to do with the fact that it alludes to, and in some respects even summarizes, though it's an early poem, or early-ish poem, a lot of the themes that we associate with him, particularly, I think, the theme of not being able to make always a very neat resolution of what things appear to be and what they actually are. I mean, that for me is really the sort of bedrock of his poetic obsession, the difference between how things appear and how they are and what bridges we might build between those two things.
All right, well, let's hear the poem.
Snow. The room was suddenly rich, and the great bay window was spawning snow, and pink roses against it, soundlessly collateral and incompatible. World is suddener than we fancy it. World is crazier and more of it than we think, incorrigibly plural. I peel and portion a tangerine and spit the pips and feel the drunkenness of things being various. And the fire flames with a bubbling sound. For world is more spiteful and gay than one supposes. On the tongue, on the eyes, on the ears, in the palms of your hands, there is more than glass between the snow and the huge roses.
I love that line, world is suddener than we fancy it. Not more sudden, but sudden.
Suddener. And it ranges all over. I mean, it's Anglo-Saxon, but it's Latinate as well. You know, there's all different tributaries flowing into the mainstream of this little poem that feels huge, actually, because of that. And so packed as well. I think Michael Longley once said that his poems are so packed, so freighted, so full of cargo, you're not sure whether they'll ever get airborne, but they do, you know. Yeah. And I've come to love about this poem.
And actually, that, I have to say there's something else about it, which I find rather complicated to say, because it sounds as if I'm rowing backwards from poet that I admire very much, and I do admire him very much, which is that in spite of, perhaps even sometimes because of my admiration for him being as intense as it is, I do find often something quite cold in him. I'm not entirely sure that cold is the right word, but removed, looking down his long, and he had a long nose at me, at his readers, in fact, slightly withdrawn, slightly lofty seeming sometimes. And perhaps I love him. Paul obviously loves him, but I think he's quite a hard poet to love, actually. Mm.
Do you think that, Paul?
Yeah, there is a kind of frostiness sometimes that sometimes is attractive and other times almost is a shutout, a lockout, if you like. Although that can be very appealing in a poem like Meeting Point, for example, Time Was Away and Somewhere Else, which is a love poem, but it's so crystalline and so well constructed. Right. The frostiness, if you like, or the kind of crystalline construction. Yes.
The formality has a lot to do with that, doesn't it? The expertise of the formality is a way of sort of keeping us all slightly outside the machine.
Because he studied the classics, which gave him that
He's a profoundly learned classicist. I mean, I think what I'm trying to get at is how is to try and characterise something that is almost a paradox, which is that, as you were saying in your introduction, the poems, for all their interest in politics, and we haven't yet mentioned the Autumn Journal and the Autumn Sequel, the two great long poems that are packed with politics as well as other stuff, for all the variety of the writing, for all the variety of the subjects, there is something very near the centre of him, which is the thing that you were saying, an interest in writing about love, what it means, how you do it, how you fall into it, and then very often how you fall out of it. And he falls out of love in his poems as often as he falls into it, it seems to me. But if that implies a kind of self-giving, a warmth, all the opposite to this frostiness that we're talking about, this aloofness that we're talking about, then that is a paradox, isn't it? And I, like Paul, I think, I tend to find the poems that I most admire are ones which manage to reconcile all the objectivity which formality implies or allows, as well as a kind of playful, sometimes rather serious detachment with a wish to give his heart away.
All right, let's hear another poem. Let's hear Karen.
The conductor's hands were black with money. Hold on to your ticket, he said. The inspector's mind is black with suspicion, and hold on to that dissolving map. We moved through London. We could see the pigeons through the glass, but failed to hear their rumours of wars. We could see the lost dog barking, but never knew that his bark was as shrill as a cock crowing. We just jogged on. At each request stop, there was a crowd of aggressively vacant faces. We just jogged on. Eternity gave itself airs in revolving lights. And then we came to the Thames. And all the bridges were down. The further shore was lost in fog, so we asked the conductor what we should do. He said, take the ferry, faute de mieux. We flicked the flashlight, and there was the ferryman, just as Virgil and Dante had seen him. He looked at us coldly, and his eyes were dead, and his hands on the oar were black with obols, and varicose veins marbled his calves, and he said to us coldly, if you want to die, you will have to pay for it.
So, Paul, that's a London poem, but also it's a poem of death. Mm. And you mentioned his late flowering. So there was a definite development in his poems later in life.
Yeah, and it was cut short and nobody saw what was coming. It's such a horrible, sad way to end it all, really. He was recording sound effects for a radio play he was producing, Persons from Porlock, which meant he needed to get some, I don't know, stalactites and stalagmites and watery subterranean dripping noises. He was up in Yorkshire recording these sound effects with a producer. And it was a very wet summer, the summer of 63, and he got soaked to the skin and developed a cough, which developed into flu-like symptoms, which became pneumonia, and then he was dead. Why didn't he just go to the sound effects library? And it's just there's something just so sad, but strangely fitting, because radio was such a big part of his. Of his life. The last 20 years of his life, he was in features and produced some, as a writer and producer, made some amazing programs. But yeah, that last book, The Burning Purge, is full of death and lots of kind of strange, labyrinthine, locked groove sort of poems, mysterious poems. But if he didn't see it coming, he might have, we can say now, felt it coming in some way.
Now, of course, we couldn't do a literary event like this at the Proms without paying tribute to the great Irish poet Seamus Heaney, who died last Friday, was a friend of poets everywhere, and he encouraged us all. We've asked Andrew and Paul to choose favourite poems by Heaney and reflect on what he meant to them. So, Andrew, let's start with you.
Well, I first shook Seamus Heaney's hand in April 1970. So when I was a schoolboy, I'd bought his second book, which is the first book of contemporary poetry that I ever bought, The Door into the Dark. And I went to listen to him and Ted Hughes talking about Wordsworth. There were about 10 people in the room, and I was one of them. And at the end, I asked Heaney, rather to Hughes's chagrin, I realised immediately, to sign his copy of Door into the Dark, and I didn't have anything by Hughes to ask him to sign. I apologised to him for that later on. And he wrote something in my book, including the date, which is why I know when I met him. And the reason I wanted to start by saying that is that it immediately allows you to understand that he was the poet in my life, the contemporary poet in my life, all my writing life, all my adult life, really. So his death, I feel, as do hundreds, thousands of other people, is a very, very grievous loss. And I had great difficulty choosing one poem of his to remember him by this evening. But the poem I have chosen, he tells us somewhere that he wrote very quickly, is a beautiful, very beautiful, short poem, which is really an epiphany, a celebration of landscape and of things in landscape, but also of the human spirit's capacity to be amazed and surprised and delighted. And I think that's something that I value in him almost as much as I value in him the ability to write so movingly about war and conflict and disagreements and so on and so forth. Speaking about love poems as we were earlier, he is a wonderful love poet, a really wonderful love poet. And this is a poem which loves the human race and what it is to be human, and to feel your heart opened up by the things that happen in the world and that you see in the world.
Okay, let's hear the poem.
Postscript. And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare, along the flaggy shore, in September or October, when the wind and the light are working off each other, so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland, among stones, the surface of a slate-grey lake is lit by the earthed lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown, headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think your paw can capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there, a hurry through which known and strange things pass, as big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open.
I know you shouldn't just pick out lines, but that last line, catch the heart off guard and blow it open, that's what great poems can do, can't they? Just catch the heart off guard. But what about you, Paul? What were your first meetings with him? And I know he's encouraged you, hasn't he?
Generosity says it all, really. I've got a Magnesian connection with when I first met him. It was on a coach full of poets going from Belfast to Carrickfergus and thence to Carrador Churchyard at a McNeice conference several years ago. And I was sitting on the bus and he came up the steps and pointed at me and said, Paul Farley, like that. And it was like I just felt so kind of rosy, you know, you just incredibly generous man. And so that's when I first met him. I've chosen a poem called The Blackbird of Glanmore. The first thing that came to mind when I was asked to do this was his book District and Circle, because we're in South Kensington. And I seem to remember somewhere him talking about being in South Kensington when he was very young and just starting out. So I wanted a poem from this book, and I picked The Blackbird of Glanmore because what you've got to understand is he was just part of the weather. He was like a North Star or something for writers born around about the time I was born. His first book came out a year after I was born. So he's just always there, which makes his loss It's like something has just slipped out of sight. You know, it's a real great loss. So the Blackbird of Glanmore also demonstrates, I think, how his work was a kind of... not only was he able to kind of pull on mythology in the classical world and other poets flowing into him, but his own work as well. By the time he's written this, it's 40 years after Death of a Naturalist. This is 2006. So it's called The Blackbird of Glanmore. So we might be thinking of blackbirds and Cabin on the Blackbird, and we might be thinking of Glanmore sonnets, the place in Wicklow where he went to retreat. But also in this poem, there's this lovely reference to a poem in his first collection, Midterm Break, about his brother who was knocked over and killed by a car. So it's an absolute echo chamber. But more than that, it's just deeply felt, incredibly moving, and stares death in the face at the end and is utterly affirmative.
We have never seen in our lifetimes for a poet. I mean, not Larkin, not Ted Hughes, both of whom are dearly loved writers. But what we have seen in the last few days has been really extraordinary. I imagine that people felt rather as we do all now when Tennyson died. But in Ireland, I mean, I doubt whether it's ever happened before, because yet the circumstances of Yeats's death were so different, and he died abroad and so on. But it has been an extraordinary few days. And one of the things that makes us think about, and this, of course, connects with what we've been saying about generosity as well, is that he wasn't exactly an easy poet, but he was a wonderfully accessible poet. So a hell of a lot of people who, frankly, don't have much time for poetry had time for him. Mm. And that means you can sit down at almost any point in the collected poems, which is a big chunk of a book, and find something that will speak to you with an amazing directness. I mean, I would just say, go and buy the collected poems.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's finish then with The Blackbird of Glanmore, read by Nicholas Farrell.
The Blackbird of Glanmore. On the grass when I arrive, filling the stillness with life, but ready to scare off at the very first wrong move. In the ivy when I leave, it's you, blackbird, I love. I park, pause, take heed. Breathe. Just breathe and sit, and lines I once translated come back. I want a way to the house of death, to my father under the low clay roof. And I think of one gone to him. A little stillness dancer, haunter son, lost brother, cavorting through the yard, so glad to see me home, my homesick first term over. And think of a neighbor's words long after the incident. Yon bird on the shed roof, up on the ridge for weeks, I said nothing at the time, but I never liked yon bird. The automatic lock clunks shut. The blackbird's panic is short-lived. For a second, I've a bird's eye view of myself, a shadow on raked gravel in front of my house of life. Hedgehop, I am absolute for you. Your ready talk back, your each standoffish comeback, your picky, nervy gold beak on the grass when I arrive, in the ivy when I leave.
Ian McMillan was in conversation with Sir Andrew Motion and Paul Farley. The reader was Nicholas Farrell, and that Proms Plus event was produced by Natalie Steed. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the BBC Proms. Welcome back for the second half of this evening's concert, given by the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra and its chief conductor designate, Vasily Petrenko. Now, he was telling me earlier that although they last played here at the Proms 5 years ago, there are quite a few new string players making their Proms debuts this evening. And not just our soloist in Szymanowski's Violin Concerto No. 1, after which they'll be ending with Sergei Rachmaninoff's last orchestral work, his Symphonic Dances, written in America, but filled with the composer's feelings for Russia and his own history, hopes and fears, thinks Petrenko, as we'll be hearing. But making her Proms debut this evening is Latvian violinist Baiba Skrida, who burst onto the international scene 12 years ago when she won the Queen Elizabeth competition in Brussels, playing the Tchaikovsky concerto. But Polish composer Karol Szymanowski's first violin concerto was a very different animal, as she was telling me earlier.
It's a completely different kind of piece. It's one of a kind. I can't think of any other piece which would be in that way. I always describe it as a painting or something you see with very, very many details. You can always look back and find some new details, and it's so fragile on one side but so powerful on the other side. And of course it's in one movement, so it's already from the form it's very, very different. And it's just fantasy, basically. It doesn't give you the idea of a traditional concerto.
Is it important for you to feel the poetry that's behind the concerto?
Very much so. It's very inspiring, this kind of piece. I've played a lot of pieces by Szymanowski by now, and I really enjoy his music. It takes time until you get into his music, and it takes a lot of time to discover many of details. I don't think it's possible to discover 100% of all of them. That's what's nice about his music. You can play all your life. But it's a very special piece also because it has such an interaction with the orchestra. It's a little bit sad because all the culmination places, almost all of them, are only for the orchestra, and I'm just in front and listening and wishing I could play with them. But it's such an interesting and fascinating piece.
Now, you must say something about the violin you're playing, because this is the one, it's a late Stradivari instrument, isn't it? And it's on loan from Gidon Kremer. Is this
a
really nice instrument to play, the Szymanowski?
I think it is, because what amazes me about this violin and what I love so much about this violin is the diversity of sound, what I can make with it. It has either the sweetness or the velvety sound, and even during this one kind of a sound I can still find levels of difference what I can do, and it just gives me the freedom of doing this amazing music with it.
Bibas Skrida, and by the way, the poem we alluded to briefly was composer's original inspiration, May Night by Tadeusz Mieczynski, depicting the poet's ecstatic reaction to a lakeside wedding surrounded by nature on a summer's evening. And here she comes, Latvian violinist Bibas Skrida, Stradivari in hand, and conductor Vasily Petrenko, making her proms debut this evening with the Violin Concerto No. 1 by Karol Szymanowski, one continuous rhapsodic movement with a cadenza towards the end, written by the dedicatee Pavel Kuchanski. Thank you.
Thank you.
fantastic and unexpected. Polish composer Karol Szymanowski describing his Violin Concerto No. 1, written in 1916 for the violinist who created the cadenza, Paweł Kochanski. And you've just heard it played here at the BBC Proms by Latvian violinist Baiba Skrida, making her eagerly awaited Proms debut. Eagerly awaited by me, at any rate. It sounds as though I wasn't alone, judging from the reaction here in the Royal Albert Hall. But Skrida was telling me earlier today she'd love to know what Szymanowski himself might have come up with if Kochanski hadn't been on hand to create that cadenza for him. And after it, such a huge orchestral climax. The solo part is suspended, basically, until it subsides. It's a wonderful moment. Here she comes again, Baiba Skrida. Vasily Petrenko behind her applauding, and she shows her gratitude to the members of the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra, all of whom clapping her debut here at the Proms. And she's such a fantastically secure violinist as well. It's a sometimes a deceptively demanding concerto. The intonation has to be impeccable, right to the very top of the E string. There are some terribly exposed shifts as well that she negotiated absolutely beautifully. Skrida bowing as the cheers of the promenaders ring around the hall. There she goes, off with the Strad, the lovely Stradivari she has on loan from Gidon Kremer. It's the third one she's had, actually, but this is the one she says she feels fits her playing really well. It's not an easy instrument to play, she says. You can't force this one. It needs a lot of air. And sometimes you just have to be led by the instrument as it tells you how to play it. But what sweetness, power, and colour is available to her in something like the Szymanowski. And she thinks it's a perfect instrument for this concerto because of those very beautiful tones on the top two strings. Warm and brilliant, she says, but never pushy. In fact, she is on stage on her own this time. I read an interview with Skrida for one of these specialist string magazines a while ago, and they asked her what kind of strings she favours, and she didn't even know what kind of E string she used. She says she gets through so many, she just uses whatever's lying around. Well, after that performance of the Szymanowski Violin Concerto No. 1, we began this evening's prom with the first symphony of a Russian composer just out of music school, and Vasily Petrenko and the Oslo Philharmonic finish with the final orchestral work by a Russian composer in self-imposed exile in America, looking back at his homeland with mixed feelings. Sergei Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances are from 1940, when the great pianist composer was in his late 60s. And for Petrenko, it feels like a deeply personal work.
In my point of view, it's autobiography. It's about his life and about his vision what happened to the empire, to the country in 20th century. At the first moment, he picturized this great agricultural empire. The first dance, it has its steps. There's really heavy steps, as if you are into the deep Russia somewhere in the village site. And then the second movement is nostalgic waltz, which I think may reflect Rachmaninoff's private life. And then the finale, which is a combination of the brutal energy of the masses and very, very brutal rhythms as well. Plus the middle section of finale, where it all goes to sentences about how beautiful it's still being. And then in the very late stage in Coda, then he has this quote from his Vespers, which in my point of view, it might be this his wish and his hope and his belief in spiritual army, in spiritual force of the people in Russia that will clear the country from evil.
Vasily Petrenko's very personal interpretation of Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances. And at the end of the first movement, he quotes the theme from his first symphony, which he'd never heard after its disastrous premiere in 1897. And in the last movement, there's also the Dies Irae chant from the Requiem Mass, overcome in the Symphonic Dances by the quotation that Vasily Petrenko just mentioned from Rachmaninoff's all-night vigil, "Blessed be the Lord." Faith triumphing over death, possibly. Well, the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra's leader, has just tuned the orchestra, and here comes chief conductor designate Vasily Petrenko to lead them through the three movements of Rachmaninoff's last orchestral work, his Symphonic Dances.
Thank you. Thank you.
The end of Sergei Rachmaninoff's symphonic dances from 1940. And for all its at times almost demonic energy, it was to be his last orchestral work. Eugene Ormandy conducted the first performance in Philadelphia in 1941. The composer lived just two more years, dying before his 70th birthday. And you've just heard the symphonic dances played here at the BBC Proms by our visitors from Norway, the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra and chief conductor designate Vasily Petrenko. Here he comes. Back onto the platform. He was telling me earlier that he feels Rachmaninoff's mixed feelings about Russia's possible future. I heard in the way he asks the tam-tam at the end to vibrate after the rest of the orchestral sound has died, and he was gesturing for that to happen, although, as I think you probably heard, it was drowned out by the sound of the cheers here in the Royal Albert Hall. And right now he's gesturing for the various soloists from the wind section of the Oslo Philharmonic to take their solo calls, not least amongst them saxophonist Geir Holm, cor anglais player Horvath Nurang, and principal oboe David Friedemann Strunk. The horn section again, and the percussion, whose mighty contribution to the end of the symphonic dances cause real vibrations here in the Albert Hall. They played Rachmaninoff last time they were here at the BBC Proms, back in 2008, with Finnish music director Jukka-Pekka Saraste. His third piano concerto with Nikolai Lugansky, since you asked. That's the kind of thing you can find out from the Proms archive online. And that little cheer was for the Oslo Philharmonic's leader, Eliza Bortnes. And you heard her powerfully projected solo towards the beginning of the second movement, the waltz. Well, they first came here to the Proms in 1987 with former music director Maris Janssens to play Prokofiev and Berlioz, and it was under his direction and with the recordings they made with Janssens, I think, that the Oslo Philharmonic really first started establishing its international reputation. Back comes Petrenko. The orchestra's standing now. Promenaders cheering, hands in the air as they clap. They're getting a really warm reception here tonight. I suspect they brought an encore. Stand by. a little gift the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra has brought with them from Norway for us. Music by Gert Veit from the Norwegian composer's 100 Hardanger tunes. And I think if I'm translating the title correctly, that means welcome with honour. If I'm right, I think they played it as an encore last time they were here at the BBC Proms as well, 5 years ago. Vasily Petrenko leaving the platform again. They're not heading home to Norway just yet. We're going to hear a great deal more from the Oslo Philharmonic in their second prom tomorrow evening. And after helping them rediscover their Slavic sound, it's back to the Austro-German repertoire that Petrenko thinks they do so well. Two generations of Viennese composers. Beethoven, his second piano concerto with Norwegian pianist Christian Ila Hadlen, and Anton Bruckner's mighty Fourth Symphony, the one he himself called his Romantic Symphony. And don't forget that it's an earlier start, 7 p.m, so that there's time to squeeze in tomorrow's late prom as well. And as Vasily Petrenko returns to the platform to stand in front of the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra, I hope you'll join us all back at the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow if you can. And waiting to welcome us, hopefully with honour, back at Broadcasting House, here's John Shea.
I certainly am. Thank you very much to Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall. And as ever, you can listen again to tonight's concert over the next 7 days via the Radio 3 website anytime you like. Well, tomorrow night's concert by the Oslo Philharmonic is just one of two visits we'll be paying to South Kensington, as Andrew just mentioned. We'll be back there at 10 o'clock tomorrow evening for a late-night concert by the BBC Singers, featuring one of Benjamin Britten's earliest works, A Boy Was Born, and the last composition by George Lloyd, his Requiem, being given its first London performance. So that's our second prom tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. Meanwhile, tomorrow afternoon, another chance to hear last week's concert by the Philharmonia Orchestra, more Bruckner, his tribute to Wagner in his Seventh Symphony, written at the time that Wagner died. There's also music by Peter Erdfisch, a first UK performance, and a Mozart overture to begin. That's tomorrow afternoon from 2 o'clock. And just in case your appetite for Rachmaninoff hasn't been sated by this evening's concert, well, Rob Cowan is including Rachmaninoff's Third Symphony in the last hour of Essential Classics tomorrow morning. That's from 11 o'clock onwards, the programme as a whole, beginning, of course, at its usual time of 9 in the morning. Now, a look ahead to Radio 3 this weekend.
In this week's Sunday feature, pioneering artist Laurie Anderson traces the roots of possibly one of the most daring and popular of all contemporary art forms.
Now, sometimes people use the term performance art when they don't know what else to call it, or when it's just so outrageous that it's not in any category at all. The way people used to say, that's so surreal. So we're going to try to get close to what this art form is.
Living and present. Laurie Anderson on Performance Art is the Sunday feature. Sunday night at 7:45 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening, and we've a Proms Plus event in 10 minutes or so, music and poetry at 10 past 10. That's followed by another chance to hear a programme from our series The Essay. Tonight, Colin Thubron considers what the word challenge means to the sporting world. That's at 10:45. And after that, Jez Nelson celebrates the composer and multi-instrumentalist John Zorn's 60th birthday in this week's Jazz on 3 at 11 o'clock. Well, the Britain centenary celebrations are gathering pace. It'll be 100 years come November since Benjamin Britten's birth. So let's hear some of his folk song arrangements now. First of all, representing Ireland and Scotland respectively, here are the Sally Gardens and O Can Ye Sew Cushions. And the singer here is someone who's just completing her 2 years as a Radio 3 New Generation artist. She's the mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnston with Alistair Hogarth at the piano.
Thank you.
Well, completing those four Britten folk song arrangements, we heard The Last Rose of Summer, before it, Oft in the Stilly Night, and the first two in the group were The Sally Gardens and O Can Ye Sew Cushions. Jennifer Johnston was the mezzo-soprano and Alistair Hogarth the pianist. And you may like to know that Jennifer Johnston will be appearing at the Proms on Wednesday evening when she sings the four last songs by Ralph Vaughan Williams. And that's the first performance of a new orchestral arrangement of them, commissioned by the BBC from Anthony Payne. It's in the second half of a BBC Symphony Orchestra concert conducted by Osmo Vanska, which also includes Goretzky's Third Symphony and Tchaikovsky's Sixth, the Pathétique. That's Wednesday evening's Prom at the usual time of 7:30. Well, before that, we've a Bruckner symphony to look forward to tomorrow night from the Oslo Philharmonic, and another one on Friday evening.
On Friday night, one of the world's great orchestras, the Vienna Philharmonic, comes to the Proms. Lorin Maazel directs them in Anton Bruckner's towering Symphony No. 8, composed as a conscious tribute to three great Austro-German masters. Before that, we'll hear music by J.S. Bach, played on Bruckner's own organ, which still towers over every Prom in the Royal Albert Hall. Join me, Donald MacLeod, for the Proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall, Friday night at 7:30, here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's now exactly 10:15. And a few minutes later than advertised, let's hear some highlights now from a Proms Plus late event recorded last Friday night in the Elgar Room at the Royal Albert Hall. It's introduced by Georgia Mann.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Proms Plus Late, where poetry meets jazz in a warm late-night embrace here in the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room. Oh, yes. Outside, the famished horn of the hunter's moon is high in the sky. And there is a good reason for that seemingly gratuitous quote from Yeats right there, and it's because tonight's band, Blue-Eyed Hawk, are named after a line in one of his poems, Under the Moon. And it is a suitable moniker, I can tell you, for a band who often use poetry as a sort of springboard for their music making. We're very pleased to be saying hello again to Lauren Kinsella. And tonight, she is alongside trumpeter Laura Jurd, who has the Dankworth Prize for Jazz Composition and last year's Worshipful Company of Musicians Awards, clinking alongside each other on her mantelpiece. And then, not to be outdone, drummer Corey Dick was named Young Scottish Jazz Musician of the Year earlier this month. And guitarist Alex Roth, the awards just keep coming. He is also a Dankworth Prize winner, and Jazzwise magazine a couple of years back now marked him out as one of the hot young players who looks set to fire up the jazz scene in the future. And versifying for us this evening is Charlotte Higgins, who returns us again to that nation of poets. She's from Belfast in Northern Ireland this time. And despite only being in her third year of undergraduate studies, Charlotte is already scaling the poetic heights. She's been commended in the Foyle Young Poet of the Year Awards. She appeared at Poetry Parnassus alongside the late, great Seamus Heaney. And she's even managed to be given the job of poet in residence at Cambridge University's Archaeology and Anthropology Museum. We'll hear from Charlotte in a little while, but starting us off tonight, we have music from Blue-Eyed Hawk.
White troubles, mellow gleaming drops away above the chimney tops. It's where you'll find me. A couple of years ago, I won the Poetry Society's performance poetry competition, which is called Slambassadors. And in the workshop following winning the prize, I was challenged to write a poem from the perspective of a British soldier serving in Northern Ireland, which is where I grew up. And this is the poem I wrote. No blacks, no dogs, no Irish. That's what the sergeant said, and we never thought to doubt him. No blacks, no dogs, no Irish. Now the old dog dozes by the fire, and the flame bathes amber across his black and tan coat. No blacks, no dogs, no Irish. That night the street was silent. The tower blocks grave as tombstones in the distance, the twin barbed wire halos above Divis, and the comforting weight of the rifle in my clenched fists. It was after curfew. She had her high heels, silver buckles on the toes held in one hand. I called after her, British Army, stop, ma'am. It was after curfew, and we'd lost a man, a boy from our unit a few days past. The shock of the car bomb blast had rocked the station from outside. We ran out to sea, and the blaze burned its image behind my eyes. She was wearing an orange blouse. And it was after curfew. I said it again. I said, I order you to stop. And in the grasping shadow of the tower block, she froze. And then she ran. I had ordered her to stop. But she stopped at once on the second shot. Rouge-lined lips in the neon mirror light, unforgiving. Every wrinkle lit high, each and every smudge outside the lines. Darling, you're fabulous. And I am. Center stage in industrial strength stilettos and layer on layer of rainbow soft silk, strutting the same old stuff every night for their ready adulation. Darling, you're fabulous. And I am. But some nights fabulous fades away in a blur of eyeshadow and affectation, and the cheap cracked mirror frowns back a bloke in a dress and some lipstick and precious little foundation. But darling, you're fabulous. And I suppose I am. Just ask the blokes who sneer in the street, what are you supposed to be, love? How would a queen like you know how to fight, darlings, I say. You wouldn't want to meet a queen like me on a dark street at night, and darlings, sometimes I'm fabulous. But sometimes, I think they're right. This is the last poem. It's about I Have a Dream speech. I wrote it for a poetry organisation called Apples and Snakes, who had an event last Wednesday to celebrate the anniversary of being exactly 50 years to the day since Martin Luther King made the speech. It is called 20th of August, 1963. 50 years ago, last Wednesday, one man had a dream of one day standing in the Capitol and hearing freedom ring like thunder from the Colorado Rocky Mountain sides, like a new wind blowing through the upstate New York pines, like many colored voices speaking out for all of us, as clear as one small woman's voice once did on an Alabama bus. And now we need to hear all of our voices, because I have heard so many people say, you don't know, man, you can't talk about race if you're not black or feminism, if you're not a woman or LGBT rights, if you're not gay. But if we create a reality where our voices can only speak out against oppression that personally concerns us, when they come for me, aren't I going to be standing here lonely? And didn't Martin Luther King himself say many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny, that we cannot walk alone. And it doesn't matter what country you call home, not one of us was born guilty. Any more than the Aryan babies in Nazi Germany were born with gas chambers and their smiles or any clue of the horrors that have been seen with their country's eyes. Look, my dad's family come from Donegal, and the hillsides in that part of the country are scar-lined with famine walls, but I don't have those same scars here on my body. I cannot carry my ancestors' anguish around with me. Old pain, like old guilt, is too heavy. And the risk is that if we carry old angers like chains round our hands, we can never then reach out for anything. If we keep our lungs tightened with second-hand hatred, then how can we hope that they'll sing and